On this episode of IT AV, counterfeit products and the impact they have on the security of our networks as well as manufacturers, and AI, which jobs they will take over and which ones they probably should. All this and more next on IT AV.
The network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is IT AV, episode 37, recorded Friday, December 20th, 2019. Touch Panel by Wix.
Support for AV Nation is brought to you by
Sure. Sound extraordinary.
This is IT AV, the monthly look at the IT and the AV industry. My name is Jamal Burton. I am your host with us to discuss the news and information we have gathered. First and foremost, Mr. Chris Fitzsimmons from BIAMP. Welcome, sir.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also with us is Mr. Michael Drainer from Drainer Technologies. Welcome, sir.
Hello, everyone. Happy holidays, New Year, all that kind of fun stuff. We're going to have a good time here.
All right. And last but not least, a buddy that I've actually met through a mutual friend here, Mr. Chris Nutto, Sean Reed. Sean is from Astroman AV. Welcome, sir.
Welcome, everybody. Nice to meet you.
And you should go to Sean's website simply for the fact that you've got really cool cartoons in AV. Yeah, right there. That's his. If you're watching the video, that's the website. If you're not, you go to his website. We'll have a link to this site. So first story here, guys, comes to us from a PC magazine. Cisco got an injunction, actually, against Chinese counterfeiters from the article, which is according to the Wall Street Journal. The temporary injunction was granted following a lawsuit filed by Cisco in New York. It pointed to four specific Chinese manufacturers in Shenzhen, which the company accused of producing counterfeit versions of its transceivers. Chris, I want to start with you on this one. There's a number of articles that have been written in this last year.
Yeah.
There was a huge seizure, I think, over the summer that had some BIAMP products, but some other audio companies' products that, you know, people, you know, secured through various means, and they were all counterfeit.
Yes.
From a manufacturer standpoint, how big of a deal is this, this counterfeit stuff?
It's a big deal. I don't think it's a surprise to anyone. I think we've been relatively fortunate, both as a company, as an industry, that it hasn't been a bigger deal. And I think there's a couple of reasons why it hasn't been a bigger deal, but it really can be a real problem. I mean, we obviously stand by our product, we warranty them, we provide customers with support for them. And so when we come across a customer that has a counterfeit product, probably through no fault of their own, we're still gonna do what we're gonna do, try and support them. We may not realize it's not a real product for some time. We may find out, you know, unless we actually get down to what serial number is this device, which isn't always the first question a support guy's gonna ask. It may be, hey, you know, what is it? It's just a Siriforte ABBVT4, whatever, or it's a Parley microphone. And so it can take time to figure out what's going on. There was a big one, I think, that happened at the end of last year that kind of surfaced in March with multiple audio vendors involved, like some Yamaha and some Sennheiser and some Shure and some whatever. And they were all relatively low complexity products. Except for, I think there was some like DBX mixer amps and stuff like that in there. And I think to some extent, BIAMP is protected by the fact that a lot of our stuff is very complicated. Like if you look, I don't know whether you've had a chance to look inside a new mic, like a Parley microphone, you know, the new beam tracking mics we have, they're very, very, very complicated. Yeah. And so to make it, even to pretend to make it, you have got to have made it. And, so it's got to come out the backside of the same factory that the original was made in, or something like that. The dark side of the factory, they say. I mean, if you go to, and you've ever been to Shenzhen or Shanghai, and in Shanghai, there's actually quite a famous counterfeit market. And you can go in there and buy handbags or whatever, and there's lots of sketchy individuals with market stalls. But they're real handbags. They just come out of the night shift, not the day shift. I'm not sure that's what's happening here with the Cisco transceivers, because they have to, unless they're literally DOA when they show up, you don't know, right? You plug it in and the lights come on and you think, okay, we're good. And then it works for a bit and then it doesn't. It's really tough. It's a real problem. But the other thing, obviously, BIAMP manufactures most of its stuff here. Certainly the Biomp Core, the Tessera line and all that stuff is all manufactured in Beaverton. So we don't have that element of risk. With the recent acquisitions we've made, obviously that's changing a little bit. So it's something we're going to have to track. You know, we use ODM suppliers like a lot of other manufacturers do to make stuff abroad. We make it in the Far East. We make it in Shenzhen. So, you know, it's obviously the obvious downside is it's a financial one for us, but there's also a reputational cost, which I think for most pro audio, commercial audio manufacturers is a bigger deal, right? I mean, really, we're not talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of units costing us millions of dollars. We're talking about damage to our reputation and credibility if people get hold of fake gear from a vendor and it doesn't work, right? And, you know, customers not always going to accept, oh, it's a fake. They see a logo and they say, oh, that didn't work. It's about the perception, the reliability of the product.
And you know, this gets to a deeper thing though about distribution, right? And buying through approved channels. And right. I saw this in a previous life as a manufacturer. You know, Sennheiser, they built their Evolution Wireless right here in the United States. You know, like you said, there's parts that come from all around the world, but it's manufactured in New Mexico. We still saw counterfeits out on the market on a regular basis.
Bits of the plastic can get out, all that kind of stuff, right?
That's exactly it. So, you know, I went into a church one time. There were all kinds of issues. And we could start going down the line and good product, get to one and I've never seen this firmware version before. Where did this come from? You know, you start making some calls and it's like, yeah, that's not our product. That's a counterfeit. And, you know, so you talk to the customer, well, where did you buy this? Oh, I bought it on Amazon or I bought it on Craigslist or Facebook or whatever the case may be.
And we're all seeing reputable sources of AV.
Yeah, exactly. And so when it always scares me when I see AV manufacturers start to open their distribution channels to places where anybody can get it, right? Where you're not authorizing these dealers, you're not quantifying them, vetting them. And, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there for the manufacturing industry. Everybody wants to get their product and service out, but we've got to keep this stuff tight. And the reason that Cisco has run into this is because you can go buy transceivers. It's a secondary part to them. A switch, an enterprise switch, you have to be an authorized partner in order to acquire and to sell. And the folks that are buying those things understand that I'm buying through authorized distributors who are getting these things legitimately. But a transceiver, hey, why do I want to go spend $2,000 on a 10 gig transceiver? I'm going to go buy this one for a few $100 and see if it works. And they're willing to hedge their risk on that. You know, I think it's very good that Cisco's making these strides. Hopefully they'll tighten up that distribution a little bit. And even those secondary parts would be able to channel through those partners who are supporting them as a manufacturer and bring greater validity to the product line at large.
All right. So let me bring up something here. And Sean, I'm going to bring you on this.
Sure.
The financial impact it has to the manufacturers, I get, right? And the time and effort wasted to the customers. Then there's the other aspect of this. I'm not throwing stones at any country or anybody, but understand that if it is a counterfeit product, there is then the risk of a back door somewhere being opened up, right? And the vast majority of AV products and obviously networking gear, this is all connected to the network, local and the network at large, the WAN, the internet. What are the risks then if, you know, a counterfeit product then finds its way, whether it's a Cisco switch or if it's somebody else's, you know, device, finds their way onto your network, and then suddenly not only is it counterfeit and you've wasted the money because it's not a real product or it's not, you know, the manufacturer's real product, but now you've opened yourself up to some sort of Trojan horse type device. How do you mitigate that?
Don't buy things on eBay, right? Well, like you said, you can find them on legitimate channels like Amazon. Or what I've seen, I'm not going to mention any names. I worked for a large retailer some years ago who does millions of dollars in business. And they buy a lot of things gray market and repackage them and print their own warranty cards and things to hide that they're gray market and got from sideways channels. And I remember one time, CEO from one of their biggest lines came in and threw a big fuss in front of everybody about, you know, you guys buying gray market, such, such, and such, and such. And the owner of the company just told him, I buy $10 million a year from you. You can either let me buy what I want to buy or I'll take my business elsewhere and get it to somebody else. They throw around their weight. And so there's always going to be that opportunity for counterfeit and gray market items to get into the chain. Companies have gotten a lot better about it. But what I've seen on my end when I'm working with the integrator or project managing is that it really comes down to all the people in between. If you're working with a reputable integrator who's buying from, you know, ideally directly from the manufacturer, from our authorized reseller, and you're dealing with an end client or end user who's committed to making sure they're doing it the right way, you don't have these problems. When you get into perhaps smaller businesses who have a smaller budget, or even government situations where you have a purchaser who's just looking at the bottom line, these things can happen. But at least in my experience, I've seen it very rarely on the integration side, only in extreme circumstances. Whereas usually someone's just like, hey, I've got this number, you got to make it fit this number. People start, someone higher up starts cutting those corners. So,
Michael, when it comes to getting stuff on your on site, and Sean, feel free to jump in on this too. If you would discover a counterfeit product or something you suspect is, what are the steps that you should take? I mean, if you're a level one, level two tech, and you're like, hey, wait a minute, you know, they spelled Biamp wrong, all right?
They put an L in it.
Like my buddy, you know, Kevin Iselli from Crestron, his famous one is Cestron, right? And what are the steps that you should take? I mean, are you immediately going to the PM of the product? You there's a hierarchy here, and you have direct, you know, you have a boss that you report to. But how are we handling this in the field, Michael?
Oh, you're asking me. I'm sorry. I thought you said Sean. So first of all, if it's a reputable integrator, they're going to take the appropriate steps to one, backtrack that channel. Where did they get that product? Did they buy it through the correct channels? If they did buy it through the correct channels, they're going to deal with those channels appropriately. But at the end of the day, they're going to do the right thing by their client and make sure that that product is fully replaced and that it is completely authorized and 100% warranted. The reputable guys are going to do that. What we see are some of these fly-by-night operations, what we like to call trunk slammers out there, that are buying through secondary and third-level distribution, buying product, and then just selling their integration services. And these are typically, like Chris and Sean said, on those open bids where there's not a lot of qualifications. It's strictly a bill of material here. Sell me this stuff. And they literally go out and shop for the cheapest price on distribution and sell that product without really understanding where it's coming from and being able to stand behind it. So, you know, the first step is just to make sure that your client is 100% cared for. You take that product out, you put an authorized product in, and then as an integrator, you deal with that moving forward, because ultimately you're responsible for delivering that solution. Now, if somebody else is providing it, then you're still that intermediary in doing the right thing. In my opinion, operating with a level of ethics and integrity is key in dealing with these types of situations.
You also need to call me, by the way, if you come right across a fake or a counterfeit or a suspicious device from a particular manufacturer.
Absolutely.
You need to tell that manufacturer, because they need to know too, right? Because if there's a problem, if there's an issue with this factory or the supply chain, we need to know about it so we can fix that too, right?
I don't know about Biamp.
Someone to tell us if they found a counterfeit Biamp product, I would be hoping that the second phone call would be to us.
It usually is. I've noticed recent years I was on a project where we had about two dozen SM58s. And I think about...
That's one of the most notable counterfeits.
It's an obvious one as a counterfeit, right? It's a ubiquitous product. Everybody knows what they think. They know what it looks like. Yeah. And you can get rid of it. You can shift them. You can't, like, shifting a counterfeit to Siraforte is a challenging...
Right. It's usually, like you said, it's not usually a complex product. No. You're not going to see a CP3N out there as a counterfeit or, like I said, Siraforte. I'm not saying there can't be, but chances are if there is a counterfeit, it's usually just going to be the chassis with a bunch of rocks inside rather than, you know, someone actually trying to build one to sell as a functioning piece.
I'm not going to go to the effort of counterfeiting all those parts, all those diodes. I'm just going to, you know.
Put some concrete in the chassis and stick it in the box.
Exactly.
But, you know, that's a valid point that Chris makes, though, is do let the manufacturer know. Because coming from the manufacturing world, what we would do is track down, okay, well, where did you acquire that product? We'd want to know that entire life cycle. And then we're going to go make test buys. And we're going to try to track that product down and figure out where it's coming from. And, you know, there's entire legal departments in these manufacturers that are responsible for tracking down this counterfeit material and shutting those channels down. And unfortunately, it is a long legal process sometimes. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with some of these very, very large distributors that we've already mentioned, a lot of times you're powerless unless you're willing to take steps to completely cut them off from your product lines, which can be detrimental to the manufacturer at large. And for the guys that have highly specialized stuff, such as we've mentioned, like the Crestron and Biamp and the DSP manufacturers and amplifiers, those are a little bit harder to do. But the commodity product, that's really where we're looking at, is the stuff that is commodity, it's ubiquitous. You got to keep your eyes out for that stuff. And at the end of the day, as integrators, as specifiers, and as end users, if we're dealing with authorized channels, we know where we're buying our product. We're not just buying on, Amazon and I'm trying to think because I don't want to just be critical of them, but there's a lot of other ones out there. But they are one of the largest culprits. They really are because they don't keep good tabs on that. And it's up to the manufacturers to push that back. So do contact the manufacturers and let them know.
And yeah, Amazon's an interesting one, though, right? I think we said up front, eBay bad, Amazon's usually okay. I have experienced a lot of bad stuff from Amazon these days. Like, so I don't know, you guys. Tim knows this. I build and fly drones, like quadcopters, from parts. So I buy motors and control boards and that kind of stuff. One place I would never buy those components from is Amazon, because I don't think I've ever received a genuine component, because it's the marketplace. It's not, it's like, you know, Walmart has a marketplace, Amazon has a marketplace. They all have this marketplace, and none of that stuff is controlled by them. It's just like it literally is a marketplace whereby there's a bunch of stores where people brought stuff in and they sell
anybody.
It. The owner of the marketplace doesn't care, right? It's kind of like, and their percentage hit rate is like, well, you know, I'm going to sell a gazillion of these and make a bunch of money on all of them. If I get caught twice and my hand gets slapped by Amazon, fine. But that's clearly the thought process behind that.
Yeah, the fines never outweigh the profit.
Yeah. Right.
You get suspended for a month. They're like, okay, I'll just most of those big companies have multiple DBAs. So they're like, okay, shut down that one. I've got seven more over here.
It's kind of like watching the European Union trying to sue Facebook. It's like, oh no, $1 billion, a boo-hoo. Same. It's exactly the same mentality.
As we wrap up this real quickly, that is one thing I wanted to point out is that the vast majority of the Amazon stories that I've heard are not getting it from Amazon proper, right? It is that marketplace.
It's a marketplace.
You know, yeah, it's fulfilled by a company you've never heard of. You're like, no, not buying that one. I was actually, just before we close out, I went onto eBay and searched for Biamp to see what popped up.
And?
Just for funsies. And actually, I'm pleasantly, I'm not surprised. Most of it's pre-owned, right? There's almost nothing new on here from Biamp. There's like a couple of expanders and a shrink wrap. But I was ready for there to be stuff there, and there really isn't. So I'm happy.
Although it's a great place to buy Audioflexes.
Right? Yeah, Audioflexes and Advantage One mic mixers.
Yeah.
I don't even know when we made that.
Here's the thing. You guys both just dated yourself. So
yes, very much so. Cobranet on Audioflex. There you go.
There it is.
All right. Next story, actually, that dovetails right now into our next story from Wired. Is AI going to take your job or make it better? From the article, AI will make phenomenal companies and tycoons faster, and it will also displace jobs faster than computers and the internet. The government needs to be able to take it. Governments need to start thinking about how to support the large numbers of people who will be unable to work because automation has made their skills obsolete. Mr. Drainer, we'll start with you on this. What concerns do we have about AI coming into the AV and the IT space? What jobs do we think that they're going to displace, and what ones should they displace?
Oh man, that is a big, big question. It's a loaded question. We are already seeing AI write code. We're seeing AI do tech support. We're seeing AI function in a lot of different capacities. And, you know, there's some good and some, you know, I I can't say that there's bad to it. I mean, the bad is the impact to the workforce, right? But it's a natural progression of things. We're going to continue to see this. There are certain jobs that are just not going to go away. Installers are going to be here forever. Somebody has to pull that cable. Somebody has to mount those devices. However, designing system flows, that is something that is going to move to AI. There are already people working on some really good algorithms that can, you load up a list of gear and it's going to figure out the optimal way to connect all this stuff, right? You know, based on the IO capabilities of the devices, it's going to do the schematics, put out your bill of materials, figure out what connectors are needed. So from a, you know, the ability to do takeoffs and design engineering, that is something that's going to happen. Is it tomorrow? No. But is it going to start progressing in the next decade? Absolutely it is. And we really have to take cues from other industries. You know, this article has a picture of an orchard. Actually, I think it's a vineyard here. I'm not sure exactly what that picture is, but agriculture is a big one to follow. We are seeing AI, autonomous vehicles, spraying, autonomous grain carts and things like that that are already operating in the current agriculture environment. And it's our industry in the IT world that is putting that stuff out there. So it's a natural progression. We're going to take those same technologies and find ways to utilize them internally as well. And all I have to say is when the machines start building the machines, it's time to retire.
All right. Sean, same kind of question. What jobs should AI take over?
I could see AI for sure taking over some of the programming. Definitely some of the service, but I think as far as the actual engineering, I think a lot of that will still stay in human hands. There is a certain amount of human touch. An AI, until someone creates an actual body for one, cannot go into a job site, do a site visit, speak to the client, and interpret their needs. There's still an organic portion of that understanding how the human being is going to interact with it. Eventually, I'm sure we'll get to a point where there will be probably some sort of device where you just enter in a set of parameters and have it scan the room. You might get there in 10, 20 years and my job will become obsolete. Oh, well, then I can go open up my orchard and buy me some robots to pick my grapes. you know, me and my blue milk out in the sand dunes, but had to go there.
I like it. Good job. Good work.
But no, I don't see it happening right away. I think there will still be a human component to the AV industry, especially residential. I think if any market commercial will be. I think eventually there will be some automation to the commercial side of AV. As what I always predicted is, I think that the hardware manufacturers are going to start to automate and the systems are going to start to become more closed. You'll see some of the other companies drop out. I won't say some names. Luna, and, you know, they'll eventually go away.
Excuse me.
Oh, sorry. I said my throat. I'm sorry. And some of the bigger boys will rise up and they'll eventually start moving more to a software-based than a hardware-based system. Won't miss any names, but I know one company that's already working on trying to go to a fully software-based EV system. And if they are successful, I think they'll push a lot of people out of the market. But you'll still need someone to come in and say, what is your need? How are you going to use it? Let me at least design some part of that system for you. I don't think AI will fully be able to understand that yet.
You're right on that part, Sean, but at the same time, you know, we take like the BIM model right out of AutoCAD, right? The architect specified this stuff. He's got his AV consultant, Sean, here in Madison, who's having these conversations. And then Sean puts this stuff into BIM. And now what's happening is BIM is feeding an AI engine, and that AI engine's generating an equipment list. And it's saying, here's the options that I want to use. Here's the IO capability, right? You load it up with a Tessera and a Core and all these different things and say, hey, here's the options. Now, what is the optimal way for IO and budget and capabilities to accomplish this goal? AI is going to be able to do that from an engineering standpoint, but from the client consultation and the art of it, yeah, I agree 100%. You're still going to
need AI won't take my job.
No.
I got this right here. Won't take my dang job.
Yep.
A pencil right in its eye.
Yeah.
Like John Wick.
Chris, hang on for a second. There is an AI program that it may not take your job directly, but certainly could, you know, create some interesting communications and some interesting marketing material if you gave it some parameters and picked out and said, you know what, I want to target 18 to 25 year olds.
Oh, we already do that.
Exactly.
Horrifying. So, well, I want to go back to a couple of things that Michael and Sean said first. So I think that the more terrifying thing that's come out of this conversation that I hadn't considered is the fruit picking robot, because we've said up front, oh, well, we're never going to have someone put in the screen. But if you can have a robot that picks strawberries, you can have a robot that puts a ceiling speaker in. Mm-hmm. I don't view those two tasks as mechanically particularly different, right? I mean, yeah, there's some doorways and some tables. Actually, it'd be better. We were having a conversation yesterday with the product management crew about where people put our new speakers. Like, oh, well, we optimize them to be down the middle of the table. They got that nice 50-degree dispersion angle. But where do we see them? Down the sides of the table, because nobody can be bothered to move the table to put them down the middle, right? That's a mechanical challenge. If you've got a robot arm with a circular saw on it, and just go cut the ceiling down the middle of the table. So anyway, that I think is challenging, actually. I think that installation part could get sucked up.
It's interesting you say that, because I saw a YouTube video just the other day about the autonomous soldier, right? And they're already working on this.
Skynet.
Well, it is Skynet. Oh,
the stupid YouTube video.
In all seriousness, though, like these robot, I don't know whether to call them a humanoid, an android, or a robot, what it is, but their ability to respond and balance and manipulate weapons and firearms and shoot and all this kind of stuff. Now take that to a simple utility role, like Chris is saying. Yeah, you're right. The possibilities do start to expand. However, I think we're a little bit further out on that.
Yeah,
than we are on some of these back office engineering work. Like we said, there's still that human element of the front office engineer, but that back office, nobody likes to sit there and just do takeoffs and count connectors. Yeah. Who likes
to do
that?
It's about where the most value is given. Like, companies that are going to invest in this technology are doing so to optimize, or will do so to optimize their business, mm-hmm. right? They're going to do it to optimize their workflow, save costs. So where are those costs? How can we address them? I think that the thing about AI is not just its potential as a kind of advanced wizard. It's actually its ability to learn. I think that's what's mm-hmm. really the most interesting thing. There's actually, I did a bit of reading about this yesterday. There's all of these website building platforms like GoDaddy and Wix, and all of those website templates are built using AI learning engines. So they're not just some art student built a bunch of templates. Mm-hmm. They continuously update and optimize their code layout. So they take an HTML template and they iterate on user flow and understanding of how the websites get interacted, and that bucket of templates that you get to choose from when you build your website on Wix, those templates are all AI driven and they're all always changing. And I think mm-hmm. that's where AV system programming and design is going to get really interesting. As soon as we can start to plug together designs in the field with a learning engine, we'll be able to produce suggested designs to a user that will be incredibly powerful. I mean, there's some steps to be taken along the way to that, but there's going to have to be conversations about how comfortable people are sharing usage information, right? We already do that with websites. We already say I'm comfortable, or at Apple, right? Am I going to share results with developers? Really what you're sharing there is your interactions with the app.
And you're not that far off. I mean,
we're not.
Why can't the Wix engine build my touch panel?
It can.
Why can't Wix build my touch panel?
The only reason it can't is the touch panel doesn't tell you how it was used because it's not plugged in.
But it could, and it should. That's cool. But the other thing this is going to do is this is going to break through something that the industry has been talking about for years, and that is the dissemination of this tribal knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. AI is going to almost force us as an industry to disseminate our tribal knowledge in the background, right? Because these systems are going to be pulling our information and what we're doing with this install versus that install, and that's going to make passing down the knowledge a little bit easier.
Data sharing and data capture, and getting comfortable with the idea that okay, this touch panel that I'm installing in my building is going to report back to the touch panel manufacturer how it was used and who pressed what where, or at least to the IT group in that organization, like how successful is this touch panel, how quickly do that kind of data allows an algorithm or a learning machine to understand and improve upon how
it's designed. It is so minor compared to what we already share out of the boardroom
here. I know, and that's what's really dumb,
so right? why are we concerned about it?
I don't know why we're concerned. I'm not concerned about it. That's why we're concerned about it. We are concerned about it.
Well, I understand that. And we've had that discussion on other episodes, right, Tim? We've talked about the privacy factors involved here. But when you already walk into the room with this, why are you concerned about the touch panel, right? Put your phones in a lockbox before you walk in if that's an issue.
People are willing to ignore this, right? Nobody wants to accept that this thing knows where you are all the time, tracks your data. Did you see that article? There was like a brand new Android phone that had never been turned on in its life, and it had been in this guy's pocket. And he did this. He was like a Wired editor or a T3 editor, and he deliberately he took this phone out of the phone store, walked around with it for a couple of days, and then turned it on. And he then exported the location data, and it knew where he'd been for the couple of days since he walked out of the phone. Like it, these devices are already creeping on everything you do. So why we're concerned about which button we press on the touch panel is beyond me. I think UI and UX and are big areas for improvement. And then, like we said earlier, like design of layouts, like this idea that you can, instead of having to click and draw lines around in DSP programming software, but literally draw boxes on a screen and draw lines between it and say, yeah, this is this, this is this. A machine learning algorithm can interpret my whiteboard scribblings and turn them into a DSP design. It's about learning intent. If we are able to provide them with enough data, like those machines that play Go and chess and whatever else, StarCraft, they learn by watching and learn by getting, you know, input data to iterate on.
So are you telling me I can blow up a Forte by making it play tic-tac-toe?
I may or may not have a firmware build of a Forte which allows you to play
All right.
On the front screen.
Star Wars to War Games.
War Games, that's right.
All
right, guys, thank you so much. That is going to do it for us. Mr. Chris Fitzsimmons, how do people get a hold of you and or Biomp?
A pleasure. Oh, well, you can visit us at www.biomp.com. Obviously, there's a exciting trade show coming up in Amsterdam in February, so you'll start to see some teaser information and exciting reasons to come see us cold Amsterdam in February. Please do if you're going to be there. It's going to be awesome.
And actually, they have two booths. Hall 3, B90, and Hall 1, H140 is their booth. Mr. Drainer, how do people get a hold of you and or Drainer Technologies?
DrainerTechnologies.com. You can catch me on LinkedIn and Facebook as well. I am on Twitter, but don't spend a lot of time there.
Okay.
So don't worry about that one.
Mr. Reed, thank you, sir. A pleasure thank to meet you. You in person. Well, virtually in person. How do people get a hold of you?
Visit our website, astromanav.com. You can find us on Facebook when Facebook isn't shutting down our page randomly for no reason. But I am on Twitter and LinkedIn as well, and I will be in Amsterdam for the show, so I'll stop by AMP booth as well. And, you know, feel free to send us a comment or post something semi-appropriate on our page, and we will try to respond.
Very good. For me, don't follow me on the Twitters, because I'll just be complaining about the Bears at this point. Go by the website, if you would, please, though, avnation.tv. That's avnation.tv. You'll find this program and a host of others. While you're there, check out our supporter section. These are the folks who help us financially, help us bring you a ITAV, AV Week, and coverage of ISE 2020 and find every one of those. So check all of that out and more at avnation.tv. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. And we have more ITAV.